The hallway, usually so full of furniture and other things to trip over, was nearly pitch black. It smelled of sawdust and stale cigarette smoke. And I walked forward slowly, with my hands out, hearing the front door bolt being thrust into place. I'd got about 10 steps along, surprised that I'd managed to avoid hitting anything, when I felt Frank's arm around my waist. I nearly screamed.
"Gone too far," he said. "Here's the front room."
He pushed me in and then went off down the hall himself. I could see better in here, with a streetlight coming in through the window. Bars of yellow light lay over the bare floor, and I went to step on them, letting them shine over my shoes. A bare floor. My gaze shot over the rest of the room. There were no rugs, and most of the furniture was gone. No curtains, no sofa, no glass dome full of birds. There was nothing familiar to tell me where I was, and there wasn't a trace of Suki. It was strange and disorientating, and reminded me of the way the town had felt on the morning after bombs had been dropped. All that was left were a few tea chests next to the fireplace, and two armchairs with dust sheets over them. They'd been pushed opposite each other, and one was taken up with a worn rug and some army blankets. "This where you're sleeping?" I asked when Frank came back.
"Don't look so shocked. It's my house. And the rest of the furniture's been sold, except for a few bits in the attic I can't get rid of. My old mum would have had an apoplexy if she'd seen how little I sold it for. But I had some debts that couldn't wait. And I'm not going to be here long."
He lit a candle and put it on the floor between us. The light made his face look almost ghoulish, and I shrank back.
"Ooh," he said, raising his eyebrows and laughing. "Like one of them Karloff films, isn't it? Oh, don't worry, I'm not going to slit your throat."
He dragged one of the tea chests over towards him.
"This is what I wanted to show you."
I had a sudden panic that it would be something improper. I wasn't really sure what that might be, but I had an idea that I wouldn't be able to talk to my parents about it. I shifted my feet, remembering the heavy clunk of the front door bolt as it had been drawn into its fitting.
"I can't keep these things here much longer," he said. "You can take anything you like."
I was ready with my refusal before he'd got the lid of the chest off. But then he pulled out a fur stole, holding it in front of the candle. Its magnified shadow scurried over the blank space above the mantelpiece.
"She only had that one suitcase with her in the hotel," he said. "All the rest of her clothes are still here. Thought you might know what to do with them. She liked giving you things to wear and that. And you got the figure for them."
His eyes slid over me, starting somewhere towards my middle, and I couldn't help covering the place with my hands, convinced I could feel an ache there. "Frank," I said then, "is Suki dead?" I saw him wince, his hand tightening on the fur. He stared at the candle flame.
"I shouldn't have gone to London after that bloody lunatic had got into the house."
"What?"
"That mad woman. She got in somehow when I was out one night, months ago. Scared the living daylights out of Suki."
"Did she run out? Screaming? Suki, I mean. Did she run out onto the street?"
"Yeah. Neighbour complained. Fussing woman across the road. Was it her that told you? Anyway, the night I had to go to London, Suki found the mad woman inside again. Gave her a fright. She seemed all right when she went off to yours for dinner, but when she came back she said she couldn't stay in the house. Her idea was to stay at your mum and dad's, and, well, we had a bit of a row on account of Douglas being there, and I don't like him. In the end, I got her to take a room at the Station Hotel instead. They owe me a few favours, We decided she'd stay there until the weekend, until I'd sorted out my bit of business, and then get the train up to London and meet me on Saturday afternoon. I was worried after she didn't turn up, but when I couldn't get hold of her at the hotel, I assumed she'd run home to your lot and didn't want to tell me.
But she hadn't run home. She'd left the hotel, left her case full of clothes, and vanished. I dropped onto my knees and gazed into the chest. Here were the things she'd decided not to pack. The green and white day dress with scalloped shoulders, and the red sailor suit with its pleated skirt. And here was the cocktail sweater, with the pearl button at the back, which she had knitted herself from a Hollywood pattern. All her beautiful clothes. All the things she'd collected and worked on. Frank went to get something to drink, and I laid the things over the arm of his chair as I dug through them. Soon I'd emptied the whole chest, and there was just dust at the bottom. Dust and something else. Something shell-like. I picked it up and held it to the candle. I nearly dropped it when I realized what it was. Part of a broken fingernail, painted pink. I could see the white marks on the inside where it must have folded before it snapped, and I curled my fingers into my fists against the ghost feeling of breaking a nail. I didn't know if it was Suki's, but there was something odd about it, something sinister. I slipped it into the matchbox in my pocket as Frank came through the door.
"What you got there?" he asked, frowning,
with a quick movement like an animal catching a scent. "Nothing," I said, pushing the box deeper into my pocket and pulling a blue princess line dress from the chair. "Do you recognize this?" He said he didn't. And when I told him it was Suki's favorite for dancing, that she'd been wearing it the night she met him, he looked bewildered.
"I didn't remember that," he said,
reaching to squeeze the fabric in his hand.
"Tell me about something else.
Tell me about when she wore all these other things." "I pull a shirt with grey stripes from a twist of clothes, stroking the front of it over my knees and smoothing out the wrinkles. I don't remember Suki wearing this. It's soft and nicely cut, but it's far too big." I look back into the case. A hard case, like you'd take on planes. There's an elastic band over the clothes, and a pair of trousers is tangled in it. Fawn-coloured trousers. But these aren't Suki's either. I'm sure I'm dreaming. This room is the wrong shape, and my furniture is in the wrong place. Wardrobe, chest of drawers, dressing table. They loom darkly in their mistaken corners. And lots of things are wrapped in newspaper, so I can't see what they are. I put on the shirt, wondering when I'll wake up. And a woman comes in. My mother, it must be, though she doesn't look quite like herself. "Good morning," I say. But the words are difficult to pronounce. My mouth is too soft for the consonants. Well, it's night time. What are you doing banging about? Have you got another bottle of gin in here or something? I thought you'd gone to bed."
"I'm awfully tired," I say.
"It's been a long day." She smooths my hair from my forehead and helps me to get under the bed covers, where it's warm, as if someone has been sleeping there. She definitely isn't my mother. Perhaps she's one of these missing women from the newspaper. Perhaps we both are.
"You don't still shop at the same fishmonger's, do you?"
The words are not quite definite. It's annoying, but the sound somehow matches the dough-like quality of my thoughts. "No," she says. I don't think she's understood. I put a hand out towards her and my elbow knocks a glass.
The woman catches it before it falls, but liquid slops over the rim. Inside is some sort of preserved corpse, like we had in school. Rabbits in formaldehyde showing their guts to the class. I can smell the dull chemicals, the undertone of rotting. That's disgusting. What's she doing here? I say.
Your teeth? She asks.
A girl I don't recognize pushes her head through the door.
What's going on? Is it a midnight feast? Shall I make hot chocolate?
Are you missing too? I say. Her eyes slip to the woman's. She looks embarrassed.
Caught.
Yes, make us some hot chocolate then, Katie, the woman says, and she speaks to me in a low voice. She tells me she's my daughter, and that this is her house, that I live here with her. She tells me it's late and time to be sleeping, that I am perfectly safe, that no one is missing.
That's not true, I say. That's not true.
I pat at my sides, but I can't get to my pockets beneath the duvet. I squeeze at it, feel under the pillows, and then reach for some discarded clothes. My feet are too hot and are beginning to sweat.
It's not true, I say, tangling my hands in the clothes.
The woman draws back the covers, and now I can get to the notes in my pajama pockets. I hadn't quite known what I was looking for, but I shuffle through the pages, and here is Elizabeth's name. She's the one that's missing. It's a relief to find out. The girl comes back with mugs, and I take a sip of my drink. It's sweet and cloying, like melted lipstick.
What was that about Elizabeth?
She asks, grinning. For pity's sake, Katie, don't get her started, the woman says. I've been through it umpteen times already today. You are aggravating sometimes. The girl continues to grin. She has a little fox-like face, and it makes me nervous. You'd better go to the loo before going back to sleep, the woman says. She takes my mug and folds the duvet away from me. The air feels cold on my feet, where they are slightly damp. Where is the loo? I say. She points, and I follow the direction of her finger, passing a mirror in the hallway. I'm wearing Patrick's shirt. I have to change it, but I can't think where my room is. Everything looks strange. I get a fluttering in my chest and I take a step towards a door. There's a sign on it. Loo, this way. As if someone knew I'd be looking. I don't know whether to be grateful or afraid. Through the door, there's another sign taped to the wall. This one has an arrow pointing right. The last door just has Loo written on it. And here I am. I draw down my pajama bottoms and little bits of paper flutter out of my pockets onto the floor. I reach for them, but I can't get them back into my pajamas while the material is bunched below my knees. I put them on the radiator next to me instead. Elizabeth's name is on them. Elizabeth, I say, as I pull the flush. Elizabeth is missing. It's somehow comforting to say it, but I feel the worry of it begin to pull at me too. I have to come up with a way of finding her. I have to make a plan. I must write it down and tick off the points as I go. The only paper I can find is a newspaper on the hall table, a Daily Echo, and I'm not sure if it will do. The front page comes away as I try to read the headlines, but I take it along to a sitting room anyway and settle into a comfy chair, spreading the sheets over my knees. There's something narrow and hard lying on the cushion next to me.
It's smooth and shiny, with lots of little numbered buttons. I wrap it up in the paper and look for apples, but I can't see any. So I wrap a pen instead, and then I wrap a set of keys. Oh, Mum, Helen says, standing over me. No wonder I can never find the remote. She peels the newspaper from something, letting the page fall to the floor. I pick it up and wrap it round my hand. Where are the apples, Helen? I say. We'd better get started. We better put them away, or they won't last till the spring. I used to like wrapping apples. It was one of those jobs people gave you to do as a child, and I can still recall the sharp smell of the newspaper ink mixed with the sharp smell of the fruit. One year, Ma and Douglas and I packed them together. We stood in the kitchen, newspaper in the middle of the table, apples in a tub at one end, and boxes ready at the other. There was a breeze rustling through the dark hedge outside our warm and cozy kitchen, and the fire in the range was slowly dying down from dinner. The kitchen light was on the blink and kept flickering above the table as if a moth were inside the bulb. Ma was the fastest wrapper, Douglas the slowest. He had a bad habit of reading the old newspapers. He couldn't seem to help it, even though he'd more than likely read every article already. There'd been a horrible murder of a woman staying at the Grosvenor Hotel the month before, and the reports were hard to miss, though Douglas didn't say anything about it. The 11-year-old king of Iraq had arrived in Britain, and Clement Attlee was coming to give a speech in our town. Douglas laughed when I asked if he thought the two were related. "They finished those new houses across the way, look," he said, lifting a newspaper and letting the light skitter over it. "They did that months ago," Ma said. "That's from February, that paper is. There'll be people living there by now, I expect." "Yeah, there are. Frank moved a family in from Christchurch," I said. "And that was March." "Did he, love?" Ma said, her voice far away, calm, but her eyes wide. She pointed to the ceiling, and then put a finger to her mouth, reminding me not to mention Frank in front of Dad. I rolled my eyes. "Frank said they got him to move stuff in even before it was finished. He got to look over the whole lot, gardens and everything. Really nice they are, he says." Douglas looked at me, and then away. "How long before," he asked, finally scrunching his page round an apple, "before anyone moved in, or before the whole street was finished?" "I don't know. He helped them fix up their gardens, though, as a favour."
"Fix them up? How?"
"Well, he brought them extra soil, and dug the ground over, and helped them plant things. Vegetables."
"Didn't know Frank was green-fingered. Which vegetables did he help plant?"
The boards creaked as Dad started down the stairs. He made the steps creak in a very particular way, not like Ma or Douglas, not like me. They seemed to groan under him. He came into the kitchen and grabbed a box of apples for the loft.
"What are you all talking about?" he said.
"Those new houses," Ma said. "Meant to be nice."
Dad grunted, starting back up the stairs.
"They've big gardens, haven't they?" Ma said. "Be nice for a family. Maybe you'll live there one day, Maud, when you get married." For a second, it seemed like an obscene suggestion. My face and hands went hot, and the smell of the apples seemed to thicken unbearably in the air. Ink came off my fingers, smearing onto the skin of the apple I was holding. I wiped it on my sweater, feeling I'd sullied the fruit in some way, and that it wouldn't be good to eat next year. Douglas was studying a page of advertisements. I watched him till I'd filled a box, and then I pulled at the paper. "Why are you looking at the ads?" I asked. He tugged it back out of my hand.
"I've read everything else."
"Ma told me to leave him alone and keep up,
I'd fill twice as many boxes as you, she said.
Douglas smiled and left the rest of his paper on the table, saying he'd take a box up to Dad. I separated a sheet of newspaper from the pile and wrapped it round an apple, pressing the creases flat against the skin, and reading the words that were still visible. According to the Postmaster General, the post office is experiencing difficulties in the aftermath of 6 years of unremitting warfare. Applications for telephone installations have now reached 300,000. I thought of Mrs. Winners and how annoyed she'd be to lose her position as the only person on the street with a phone. And I was about to say something to Ma when I noticed a headline bunched around the apple stalk. Women, contact your husbands. It was another story about the Grosvenor Hotel murder. The reporter said that the town was in a panic since the discovery of a second body further along the coast. And now local people were worrying that more of their womenfolk had become victims of the vile murderer. In the opinion of the writer, police, who were investigating the crimes, were being kept busy by dozens of men whose wives, it turned out, had just run off. Hasty war marriages had led to even hastier departures. The article urged these women to let their anxious husbands know they were alive and well, because, in light of the recent murders, it was important that they weren't registered as missing. I read the story again. Could Suki be reading the same thing? I remembered the little flutter of hope I'd felt at the idea she was just hiding from Frank. And I went through the pile of papers on the table with a new sense of purpose. There were several other articles about both men and women going off without saying a word to their families, and a letter to the editor from a man who'd found his wife was living just the other side of town under an assumed name. He'd only discovered her because she still went to the same fishmongers. So that could be it, I thought. She might have run away from us, from Frank. But the panic that the first reporter had written about had begun to infect me, too. What if the alternative was Suki lying murdered somewhere amongst gorse bushes? What if the murderer had attacked three women, not two? Chapter 15. If I turn left and left again, I'm in the kitchen. I have that written down. And there's a soapy smell in here that reminds me of the walk to Suki's house, and a woman bundling a mass of sheets and towels into a washing basket. That letter's for you, she says, straightening up and nodding to the envelope on the counter. From Tom. And he sent us a photo of their cat for some reason. I'm sure he expects us to be thrilled. What do you want for breakfast? I'm not allowed to eat, I say, picking up the photo. That woman told me.
What woman?
The woman, I say. God, I'm sick of explaining myself all the time. That woman who works here.
Is that right?
She works here.
What are you talking about?
You know the one. Yes, you do. She works here. Always busy, always cross, always in a rush.
I think you mean me, Mum.
No, I say. No.
But maybe I do mean her.
What's your name?
She makes a face at her pile of washing. I'm Helen, she says.
Oh, Helen, I say. I've been meaning to tell you. That girl you've hired, she doesn't do any work. None. I've watched her.
Who are you talking about now? What girl?
The girl, I say. She leaves plates by the sink, and there are clothes all over the floor of her room.
Helen grins and bites her lip.
Pretty good description.
Mum, that's Katie.
I'm not bothered about her name, I say. I'm just letting you know what she's like. You should ask her to leave, I think.
get someone else if you must. I always did the housework myself at your age. But then the younger generations expect everything to be easy.
Mum, that's Katie, Helen says again. Your granddaughter.
No, can't be, I say. Can't be.
Yes, Mum. My daughter and your granddaughter.
She puts the washing basket on the table and shakes out a large piece of material. Some socks fall into the basket. I feel I've had a shock, but somehow I can't quite think what it was. I stare into the half-closed eyes of the cat in this photo. It's black and white and lolls in a mass of bright nasturtiums, crushing them beneath it. And I wish I could lie down in a bed of flowers. But Helen would tell me off. She's very precious about the things she grows. I move about the kitchen, opening and shutting drawers. There are a lot of orange balls stuffed into one of them, like the eggs of some exotic bird, except they're not smooth, but crinkled, like screwed-up newspaper. I begin to flatten an egg out and find it's made of thin plastic, and there are handles at one end. I can't think what sort of bird it is, though. I ask Helen, and she grimaces.
Oh, God, I really ought to do something with those. I don't know how I manage to forget my reusable shopping bag every single time.
She looks at me for a moment, and then smiles.
Early onset, do you think?
The front door opens, and Helen takes the flattened egg and shoves it back in the drawer. She says something I can't catch. Something about clothes on the floor. I look at the socks in the basket. Hi, Grandma, Katie says, coming to stand in front of me with outstretched arms. This is me. Hello, you, I say. So do you know who I am? Of course I know who you are, Katie. Don't be ridiculous. Katie laughs and turns to her mother. She's cured. What is she talking about? I say, looking over at Helen. Your daughter's mad. Oh, Grandma, Katie says, putting an arm around my shoulders. One of us is. She takes her arm back and moves away, and I follow her into the corridor. But in an instant, I find I'm lost. Everything is unfamiliar. I feel as though I've gone through the mirror in that story. What's it called? I look at my notes and find one with directions to the kitchen. I follow them. Perhaps there'll be a little bottle or a cake with an Eat Me label. I find Helen instead. Helen? Where am I? I ask. This isn't my house. Is it? Somehow I can't be sure. It's someone's house. I have been here before. Perhaps it is mine. I can't think of another house just now. I can't think of any other rooms to compare this one to.
This is my house, Helen says, putting down a tray and holding a chair out for me to sit in. Let's have a cup of tea, shall we? I've made you some toast.
I pick up my cup and she watches me drink. I might get some cake when I'm out, she says. She has a crafty look. She's trying to hide it behind a smile, but I can see it.
What kind of cake would you like?
I ask for coffee cake.
I don't like coffee cake, so I can't be tricked into eating it.
She takes the tray away.
She's taken it somewhere. Or to someone.
To the Yanks in the Naffy, is it? To serve them breakfasts of sausages and beans? I wonder if she'll bring me any. Her shield, her winged rain shield, is lying on the table. So I'm not the only one who forgets things. I put my hand through the loop of material on the handle and hold my arm up, watching the raining rain shield dangle as I drink my tea. There is a newspaper here too, and I fold it into a tiny rectangle, making the creases as sharp as I can. A girl walks past the door, collecting things from the shelves in the hall. She's stealing them to give to the madwoman. I can see her from where I'm sitting, putting a coat on, stuffing her pockets. I stand and grab my bag. The front door slams, but I open it only moments later and follow her down the path. At the turn in the road, she stops. I stop too, and pretend to be looking at the heads of some dying sunflowers. They hang over a garden wall, the seeds falling onto the pavement. I gather some up and put them in my pocket. When the girl starts walking again, I copy her. And then, as I get to the main road, I see her break into a run. A bus is waiting at the stop. She jumps on and it pulls away. I've lost her. She's gone. And she won't come back. Never, never, never. I turn towards home. There are bits of rubbish all down the middle of the street. A trail of banana skins and newspapers. There's something I was going to do with newspapers. Use them. Read them. Something. I bend to peel a bit from the tarmac, trying to read the words. But there are sludgy smears across the page, and it doesn't smell right. I drop it by my feet. A miniature bottle lies against the curb. What's that story about a little bottle? Drink me, it said. I can't remember the rest. Anyway, this bottle says Macallan whiskey. And I don't think it was whiskey in the story. That's something Frank used to drink. He had a bottle with him once when I met him. It wasn't miniature either. He drank it sitting in the car at the end of our road while I told him everything I could remember about Suki. He said he wanted to think of her the way I did, wanted to try and get her straight in his head so he'd never lose her. We sat close in the half-dark, a street lamp breaking through the shadows, lighting up swirls of cigarette smoke. It was stuffy, but I didn't mind. Cars were wonderful. In a car you could just sit. You didn't have to be getting on with anything. You didn't have to prepare vegetables, or dig the garden, or run sheets through the mangle. In Frank's car, all I had to do was talk, to remember the details he'd forgotten. The name of Suki's perfume, the flowers she liked, the column she always read in magazines, and, once again, what she'd said the night she met him. He liked that memory best. How Suki had come home happy and dancing, how she'd taken off her blue dress and sung to herself as she put cold cream on, and how she'd lain in the dark in the next bed and told me she'd met this man, this handsome man, who'd winked at her and grinned. And how she'd known, right then she'd known, she'd met the man she was going to marry. I told the story, studying the shape of the space between us, the gap between his thigh and mine, and he stared out at the street. And then he cried, not really with tears, but hunched over with his eyes shut. I touched his hair at the back, where there wasn't any Brill cream, and he curled his fingers round my wrist and brought it to his mouth. I found I was trying not to breathe.
"This evening, Maud," he said, "when I saw you coming towards the car, I thought for a minute it was her. You don't know what that did to me."
He held my wrist for a long time. When he let go, it was to take a drink from the bottle of whiskey which rested on the floor against his ankles.
A crease had formed in the sleeve of my jacket, Suki's blue suit jacket, and I smoothed the hand along it, trying to make the material lie flat. And suddenly, he leant over, pressing his face into my neck. I kept very still. I didn't dislike it exactly, but I was in terror of what might happen next. "Frank," I whispered. He sat up then, and I clambered blindly, clumsily from the car, hurrying when I realized he was getting out too. But he only leant against the lamppost, watching as I walked home unaccompanied. It made me think of the time when he and Suki were courting, and I would see them huddled together there under the dimmed streetlight, wrapped in his big tweed coat, kissing. That was another memory I saved up for Frank.
"Strange company you keep,"
Douglas said, as I came through the back door, the overhead light shining harshly on his face, making him look ill. "What are you talking about?" I asked, struggling out of my jacket.
"I saw you in the car," he said, "with Frank."
There was a newspaper, folded very small, lying by his clasped hands, and I looked at it carefully while I thought how to answer. The Grosvenor Hotel murderer had been caught, and there seemed to be no doubt he'd be hanged, despite the fact that the trial wasn't due to start for months. "Of course. Always waiting around outside, aren't you, Doug?" I said. "I'd say you were the strange one." He looked down at the newspaper, too, and I caught a flash of the hurt my words had caused. The hard blink, the creep of a blush. I felt a sudden exasperation with him and batted the newspaper onto the floor. He didn't react, but stared at the table where the paper had been before picking it up again and squeezing it.
"It's not the first time you've been with him," he said. "And wearing her clothes, too. What are you doing, Maud?"
I shrugged, the jacket still in my hands. I hadn't even looked at the velvet bolero Suki had given me since Frank had let me have all her other things. It was wonderful to dress up and to go out after dinner in new outfits, even if it did mean lying to my parents about where I was. I didn't know what I was doing, but I wouldn't feel guilty. I wouldn't let him make me feel guilty. "She was my sister," I said. But he wasn't listening. His eyes weren't on mine. They were running over me, narrowing over my body.
"They're her clothes," he said, standing.
He took a step towards me.
"Take them off. Give that here."
He yanked at Suki's jacket, looking at me so fiercely that I backed away, letting go of the collar before it tore. "Doug," I said, "it's nothing to do with you." I got to the sink and he put his hands on it, trapping me.
"Playing at being her. That's what you're doing. Wearing her clothes. Going out with her husband." "What does he do? Take you back to their house, to their bed?"
"Don't be disgusting," I said, cheeks burning. "We just talk about Suki, that's all." I looked away, trying to put some space between us, and he grabbed my chin with his fist, squeezing it the way he had squeezed the newspaper, shifting closer.
"You're even wearing her lipstick," he said,
his face an inch from mine.
"Get it off."
The side of his hand rubbed over my mouth roughly, pulling at my skin and crushing my lips against my teeth. I could feel the makeup smear across my cheek and tried to turn my head away again, but he held my chin tightly.
"Stop it," he said, his breath hot on my face. "Stop trying to replace her. You can't ever replace her."
"All right, no need to hiss at me," I say.
"I wasn't hissing," the driver says, "but you do need to show me your pass."
I'm on the bus, but it's not moving, and the doors are open behind me. An umbrella dangles from my wrist, and the weight of it, the movement as it swings about, is distracting. I can't find my bus pass.
I know it's in my bag. I never take it out. But I can't see it. I have a thing for hair, for dragging out the tangles, a packet of polo mints, a photo of a black and white cat, and a thin plastic wallet. I push them all aside and put a hand in my pocket. There are lots of bits here, lots of little bits. I can't think what they are, but they make me think of flowers and gardens and something else. Something to do with the Bible, perhaps? A phrase from the Bible? "Were it earth in an earthy bed," I say. That's it. I remember it from school. I wish I could think where it's from.
"What?" the driver asks, peering through his glass partition. "Come on, love, you're keeping us all waiting."
I turn to face the other passengers. They're sitting, looking at me, and I can hear their Helen-like sighs. My face feels suddenly hot. For some reason they're impatient to go, but I don't know what I'm to do about it.
"Why don't you let her on?" someone calls out. "You can see she's old."
The driver puffs out a breath and tells me to go and sit down. There's a moment before the bus can pull into the traffic, and through the window I see a man on the pavement, standing, ripping the plastic from a pack of those things. Little sticks, not whistles. The things you light up. He breaks the plastic and then goes on biting. First the cardboard, and then the contents of the packet. Bits of tobacco sticking to his teeth. His face is like a grin, and he looks at me as he bites, and his quick, sharp movements are frightening. I think of the man running down the hill after his hat, and my father telling me not to stare, and I wish suddenly that someone was with me. Anyone. I'm grateful when the bus moves on. We drive past the park and Elizabeth's house, past the acacia tree with its long milk bloom. There, that's the same bit of something from school. I'm not sure it is the Bible. I can't remember any more, though. The bus vibrates whenever it stops, and I feel as if my bones are turning to jelly. There's a newspaper on the seat next to me, and I hold the edge of it, fluttering the pages in my fingers. "You can put advertisements in this newspaper, and all you have to do is go to the office and ask." I smile and read the shop signs and road signs aloud. It's starting to spit out there. Tiny drops of rain appear on the windows, like flecks of toothpaste on a mirror. An old couple get off by the supermarket, and I find I have a sudden longing for Patrick. He would always hold my hand when we took the bus together. Just for a few minutes, getting on, and the same getting off. Then we would break apart naturally and sit or walk side by side. He would do the same in a crowd, putting a hand out behind him, reaching for me. I miss that. I see the building I want too late. By the time I've got up and pressed the bell, we're two stops past, and I have to walk back. The Echo's office looks nearly the same as when I was a girl. It makes me think of the pictures. Very glamorous it is. Very modern, but in a nice way. Not like the modern buildings they put up now. Inside, there's a woman behind the counter. She has fat cheeks like a baby, and they bunch when she smiles. "How can I help you?" she says. And I think it sounds like there is a word missing at the end of her sentence, like she wanted to say love or dear, and stopped herself. We look at each other, and I try to think of something to say, but the word baby just goes round and round in my head. I rummage in my bag and find a photo of a cat lying in a bed of nasturtiums. I can't think where it's from.
Was it a competition entry? The woman bends slightly and her arms disappear from view. I can hear her leafing through papers under the desk. I thought all the winners for this month have been notified. I'm sorry. But you haven't lost. Just give it another try next month. Lost, I say, dropping the photo onto the counter. I've lost Elizabeth. She pauses a moment and straightens to look at the photo. Oh, was it an advert you wanted? Breath floods into my lungs. Yes! Yes, that's it. I wanted to place an advert. I'll get you a form. Awful cats, aren't they? I nod, feeling as though I've missed some part of the conversation. I nod, but I quite like cats, and I wonder what this woman has against them. I remember when my auntie lost her Oscar. She was frantic. Missing for weeks, he was. Phoned him in a beach hut in the end. Have you asked your neighbours to look in their sheds? I stare at the woman. I can't imagine finding Elizabeth in a shed. But perhaps it is a good suggestion. Perhaps it's just me it doesn't make sense to. I borrow a pen and write beach hut on a scrap of paper. The woman slides me a form with lots of boxes and spaces for writing. I look at it, and I must look at it for some time because she leans over and puts her head close to mine. Write what you can. I'll help if you're struggling. Write, I say, lifting my pen and pointing it at the form as if it were a wand and could think up the sentences for me. People do love their animals in this country, don't they? Makes me proud, actually. Not like that in Turkey. My brother's got a place there, and you wouldn't believe the number of skinny cats wandering around with no one to look after them. I look at her, and then back at the page. I've written Turkey for some reason. I cross it out. Here, she says. Let me. She spins the paper towards her and rests against the counter. She asks when I last saw Elizabeth and where. I'm not sure about that. I look through my notes and find my name and address and telephone number. I give her those in case they're important. She asks what colour I'd say Elizabeth is. And I'm surprised for a moment. But I suppose she could have been black or Indian. She asks if Elizabeth has a collar. And it seems like an odd question. I look at my notes, but I can't find an answer. I do have my name and address and telephone number, though, so I give her those. And these are your details, she says, taking the note. Thank you. I'll keep them there. See? I've written them in already. Okay. And is Elizabeth microchipped? I don't recognize the word. I shrug. We'll leave that out then. Never mind. It's not very detailed so far. And it seems funny to put her name in when there's no collar. I mean, she's hardly going to identify herself, is she? No, I say, laughing. But I don't quite understand the joke. Well, have a read over what we've got. I look at the sheet. It's a strange jumble of words and lines, and I'm not even sure which bit I'm supposed to read. But there is a title. Missing Cat. I don't want this, I say. I don't want this word. I put my finger over it, trying to lift it off the page. She waits for me to move my finger before she reads it. Cat? But I really would advise... You see, we don't mention it anywhere else. Don't we? All the same, I don't think cat is right. She crosses the word through. Up to you, she says. I like her last name too. Markham. Elizabeth Markham.
The woman makes a face, one fat cheek bunching. But she writes the name down anyway. Part of the family, is she? Wait. She stops suddenly and covers the paper with both hands. We are looking for a cat, aren't we? Cat? I can't think what it means. I don't think that's the right word. Cat? No, I don't think so. Oh, sorry, love. Elizabeth Markham. It's a person, is it? You must have thought I was off my rocker. Right, let's begin again. She pulls out a new sheet of paper and writes something down. I show her my phone number. I've kept it simple, she says. I'm assuming it's an old friend. Yes? At the moment, it would cost £7.22, but if we put it in a box with the phone number up large, it'll only be £4.14. Don't ask me why. Something about price brackets. I just do what the computer tells me. That suit? I feel a bit stunned. The numbers roll around in my head. I get my purse ready, but I can't work out what she's asking for, or what I have. All right, if I have a look. She takes the purse and counts some coins onto the desk. There. 4:14, okay? It'll be in this weekend. And somehow I'm out on the pavement. Rain is coming down, slanting over the road, and drops hit my face like pinpricks. A lorry roars by, and the noise of it makes me shudder. I look along the street after it, not sure where I am. All the buildings seem to be made of glass, reflecting the traffic back at me. Drizzly, wavering traffic. There's something hanging from my wrist, heavy and swinging. I can't think with it swinging there. I try to shake it loose, but it won't come off. A car swerves round me, beeping, screeching, as I start to cross the street. And I stumble onto the curb, clutching at my cardigan. It's soaking, and so are my trousers. I feel up and down my body, squeezing the fabric of my clothes. I'm wet through. There are drips running from my hair, and my toes squelch when I move. The rain seems to send the smell of petrol up into the air, and I stand, shivering, looking out at the wet road where rainbows of oil shimmer. I was on a curb like this when the madwoman chased me, hitting and shouting at me. The thought makes me hunch in anticipation. I start to take off my wet things, pulling my sleeves over my hands, and an umbrella slips off my wrist. It rolls onto the road, and a car whizzes past, sending it hurtling into the middle. I'm too frightened to go after it, but look at the umbrella where it lies, and think about the shock of the bang on my shoulder, and the way the mad woman shouted. I thought at the time I couldn't hear her words, but now I find I can remember them clearly. "Saw you," she said. "In the car with Frank, playing at being her, wearing her lipstick." I rub at my mouth now. The sleeve is wet, but so is my face. You can't replace her. You can't ever replace her. And then I ran into the kitchen, and Ma went out to tell her off, to tell her I was too young to be knocked down by a bus. And Suki said, "Thank you, Mops," and kissed me on the head. No, that's a jumble. But I can't work out where I've gone wrong. There's a ribbon by my feet. A green checked ribbon. It could be Suki's. The ends are frayed and the silk is stained and grubby, but I wind it carefully around my finger as I walk along. My pocket's full of something. Seeds of some kind. I must have bought them for a snack. I pop one in my mouth, but it doesn't taste quite right, and I spit it out. At the end of the road, I find a mass of people huddled beneath a glass ceiling which stretches over part of the street. They are holding shopping bags and looking up at the sky. The rain patters above them, the sound mixing with their chatter.
I think I hear someone call Grandma. I walk under the edge of the shelter and hear it again. Grandma? Grandma! Katie is tugging at my cardigan, her eyes big. What big eyes you have, I say. But it's the wrong way round. She should be telling me. You're soaked, she says. What are you doing here? Oh, Katie, I say, clutching at her hand, limp with relief. I don't know where I am. I'm so glad you're here because I'm lost. And Katie, I don't know where I live. I can't remember. It's really terrible. A couple of other teenagers are sitting on the back of a bench, their feet on the seat. One has a bright streak in her hair. I've got to take her home, Katie calls to them. Come on, Grandma. She takes her jacket off and puts it round my shoulders, rubbing my arms. I start to feel wobbly. I'm tired and want to sit down. Shall we get something to drink? She says, pointing out a cafe. It's one of those dimly lit coffee shops where sleek-haired women sit at tables in the window, and a man with suede shoes lounges on a leather sofa. Katie opens the door for me and waits, her head on one side. Aren't you coming? She says, when I pause. I peer in through the window again and scrabble in my bag for something, anything. There's a bit of seed in my pocket, and I arrange it carefully on one of the tables outside. No one is sitting there, with it being so wet. Inside it's very noisy and smells of damp clothes and hot milk. The people behind the counter seem to be doing a sort of dance, and the customers shout instructions for it. I would be too shy to come to a place like this usually, but Katie seems to belong here with her piercings and bright clothes. She is even wearing suede shoes. What would you like? Katie says, already in a queue. Tea. Oh, Grandma, the tea won't be very good here, she says. How about a latte or something? I say, all right, I'll have that. And go to sit in a big armchair, watching her order and pay and come towards me. If I look away, will I forget who she is? Here we are, then. She puts the cups down. My drink has a sort of foam on top. I've seen her drinking something similar. Milkshake or something, is it? I say. No, latte. Milky coffee. So that's what she meant. It's quite a relief. I never did like milkshakes. There was a place that did them on the pier when I was young. It was like an American diner, only it served tea and fish and chips as well. We used to go there after the pictures. Katie pats a wadge of paper napkins over my head. For a moment, I'm taken aback, outraged. Dry you off a bit, she says. Am I wet, then? I look out of the window. It's raining. And now I can see that this is the street where the ABC cinema was. Tub Street, I say, nodding at it. Katie stops her patting. No, Grandma. Bath Road. I smile to myself. Tub Street. That's what Douglas called it. He went to see some film about gangsters not long after he moved in as our lodger. And he started making up nicknames for the local roads after that. So Blackthorn Road became Tree Street, and Heron Court became Bird Street, and Portland Avenue became Stone Street. Dad asked him one day why he couldn't leave the bloody names as they were. He rarely got cross with Douglas, but I suppose as a postman, he felt that the names of streets were sacred in some way. Tub Street's changed an awful lot. They must have pulled down the cinema to make room for these ugly great buildings. No wonder I didn't recognize it. The place I knew has been buried.
soil upon soil.
It's such a shame, Katie, I say.
I know, Grandma, I know.
She's humouring me. A wet lump of tissues folds into themselves on the table. It looks like that modelling clay stuff the children used to play with.
I can't get hold of Mum,
Katie says, holding something to the side of her face.
She's probably on the phone to the police or something.
What's that you've got against your ear? A shell? Who is it you're listening to?
I say. Douglas had a shell, I remember. I watched him discover it in Suki's case. He felt all around the edges and found it in the lining. And then he held it to his ear, and her voice came out, and she told him how she'd met the man she was going to marry.
Handy, Katie says, but this is just a phone, I'm afraid. And at the moment, I'm listening to a woman telling me the number I have dialed is busy. Never mind, we'll go home in a minute, after we've drunk our coffee.
Coffee is good for the memory, I say. She smiles and sits back. I think of telling her that I've forgotten why we're here, but she looks so happy, and I'm worried about how she might react. She curves her hands round her cup and sips. Her nail varnish is chipped. The nails are very short, and I wonder if she bites them, or if she's just broken them all. Broken them, and left them in a box. Every little nail in a separate little box.
Your coffee's going cold, Katie says.
I have curled my fingers tightly into the palm of my hands, protecting the nails, forcing them against the skin. It's an effort to uncurl them, but I hook one finger into the tiny handle, which, as it turns out, isn't much use. The cup is huge and heavy, and I spill quite a lot of coffee on the shiny wooden table.
Whoa,
Katie says, springing forward to hold the cup steady. Helen would make an irritated noise now. But Katie laughs.
Bit too big for your hands, isn't it? She says, and makes me feel delicate rather than clumsy. Let me get you something.
She pushes the lump of Play-Doh into the spill and goes off. Brown seeps into the white, like a sugar cube held on the surface of a cup of tea. Katie comes back with a tiny cup.
It's for espresso, really, she says. But we can just decant a bit at a time.
She pours some coffee into the little cup and hands it to me, grinning. I sip the warm liquid, feeling like a giant in a fairy tale. I can't help smiling at her. When I've finished my cup, she refills it. I wish I could remember why we're here.
We'll go in a bit, she says. You'd better go to the loo, hadn't you?
I get up to do as she says. The lady's door has a wooden cutout of a girl on it. Inside, there's an old woman hunched into a cardigan. I step aside to let her pass, but she steps aside too. I step back. So does she. I walk closer. It's me, in a mirror. I put a hand up to rub against the glass where my mouth is reflected, leaving a mark which makes it look as though I'm wearing smudged lipstick. I go hot at the sight, feeling embarrassed and uneasy, and I scrub up my mouth with the back of my hand. It's awkward getting the cubicle door closed. I seem to have too many layers on, too much padding. Once I'm inside, though, I have the urge to stay. It's cozy and safe in here, like my mother's larder. And I remember a moment when the children were small, when I'd had enough. I remember I went and stood in the larder and shut the door. Tom and Helen clattered about, calling for me, whining at each other, but I stayed very still and made no noise. I don't know how long I would have stood there. Perhaps not for very long. But Patrick came home unexpectedly and found me.
"Hiding from our own children?" he said.
He was shocked, but I don't remember him being angry. And years later, when he'd been away working for months, he remembered my hiding place and pulled me into the larder for a kiss while the children were occupied with the gifts he'd brought home. But the two of us together were too noisy, laughing and knocking against the rows of jars. So the kids knew we were there and made yuck noises and told us we were too old to kiss each other. Grandma? A familiar voice comes through the gaps between the door and floor. Are you all right? I pull my layers straight and struggle out. It's a girl. She looks like Helen, but younger, with blondish curls and a piercing in her lip. She smiles, and I feel as though it's a question. Shall we go? She says. Are you feeling up to it? Bus stop's only across the road. A jacket is held up for me. It's not mine, but I let her tuck it round my shoulders anyway, not liking to say anything. I hope the owner doesn't mind me wearing it. Through the door is a coffee shop. I don't recognize it, but this young Helen leads the way. She walks ahead and puts a hand out behind her all the time to make sure I can keep up. I follow her to a bus shelter. Do you know, I ask, when I've caught my breath, where is the best place to plant summer squash? There's a grin and a shrug. I don't know. You'd have to ask Mum. Though probably you shouldn't. That question winds her up like crazy. It's almost better than asking where Elizabeth is. She gives a squeal of delight at the thought and helps me to sit down for a moment. We don't have to wait long for the bus, and Helen, or whoever she is, finds my pass quite easily in my bag. Where are you taking me? I say. I say it several times, but I can't catch the answers. I hope we're going somewhere with a kettle. This trip has really taken it out of me. I can't wait for a cup of tea. We get off the bus and walk a few streets. There is rubbish all down the middle of the road. Mostly newspapers. I suppose the bin men have been this morning. Helen leads me up the side of a house. It's a new house. Newly built. I don't like it. I never like new houses. You don't know what's buried beneath them. Elizabeth has a new house. I never liked that either. Helen! This isn't right, I say. This isn't my house. I'm Katie, Grandma, she says. And you live with us now. Remember? You moved in with us. I look back along the road. The rubbish on the street swells round the lamppost. And suddenly I remember what I was going to do. Oh, Helen, I have to go to town, I say, turning. I have to go to that office. What office, Grandma? You can't. We're home now. I have to go to the Echo's offices, I say. Why? You're going to be a paper girl? I can't smile. It's too important that I don't forget. No, I say. I have to put one of those things in the paper. A thing. For Elizabeth. I can't think of the word. To say I'm looking for her. What? Helen says, walking beside me. Like an advert? I'm not sure if that's what I mean, but I nod anyway. I don't think that's a good idea, she says. I don't think Mum would like it. Aren't I your Mum? I say. No, you're my grandma. I'm Katie. Katie. Your granddaughter. I stop and look at her face. Yes, I know her. Of course I do. But apart from that piercing in her lip, she really could be Helen, years ago, with her blondish curls. Except she looks happier somehow. My daughter must be a good mother, I think. Better anyway than I was. We walk back to the new house. There are seeds scattered over the pavement. The head of a sunflower has been pulled off and is lying on the wall. Katie gets out a key. "This isn't right," I say to her, pointing. "This isn't my house." Katie squeezes my hand in hers. "Come in for a bit anyway, Grandma," she says. "Mum said she'd get some coffee cake."
"I don't like that."
"Well, what about a banana sandwich then? You liked that yesterday."
"Oh, yes," I say.
Banana sandwiches were a real treat when I was a girl, and I even used to ask for them instead of dinner. I remember I was hoping to have a banana sandwich for dinner the day I met Nancy from the station hotel again. I was in the queue for the greengrocers. It was a long queue, and there was a line of prams parked outside, each with a little head rising up from time to time to squawk for its mother. The pile of bananas just inside the window was what everyone was queuing for. It was huge and looked like it would last my turn, but I tried not to think too hard about them in case that caused them to disappear. I leant against the brick wall of the shop and made faces at the babies in their prams, the smell of sun-warmed fruit washing about me like bathwater. Ma had sent me out with the ration books as she and Dad were spending the day talking to the police and following up any leads for Suki. Sergeant Needham had suggested they retrace her steps from home to the hotel, from the hotel to our house, and from our house to hers, looking out for anywhere she might have been lost. I had a fairly good idea that the sergeant was just suggesting things to keep them occupied, but I hadn't said anything to Ma. She'd seemed more hopeful than she'd been for months, and I hadn't the heart to tell her I'd already followed those routes myself, again and again, looking for answers. Instead, I'd set myself the task of getting the ingredients for a really good dinner, but I hadn't had much success with the shopping so far. Someone had told me there was haddock at the fishmonger's, and I'd rushed off to see if I could get hold of some. But by the time I reached the front of the queue, there was only cod left. So all I had so far was a tin of Heinz tomato soup. If I could get us a banana each, though, that would be a bit of a triumph. I was still 6 or 7 places from the front when Nancy tapped me on the shoulder.
"Hello, it's you," she said. "I thought I recognised you. Feeling better now?"
I said I was.
"And any news about your sister?"
"None."
She nodded. "Sorry about that."
She shifted her shopping bag from hand to hand, puffing her flat cheeks out.
"What are you after?" "I'm for the bananas if they hold out. My husband loves them."
"Was it you who signed Suki's name on the register?" I asked.
"Oh, at the hotel, you mean?" "Yes, that's right."
"Why?"
"Frank asked me."
"But couldn't Suki have signed it?"
"She was outside in the van. He wanted to pay and get the key and everything first, so he could take her straight up to a room. She was in a bit of a state, he said. Poor love, so was he. Worried for her, I expect. That wretched madwoman had got into their house again. Not that I'm one to talk. My husband's got his own problems."
"So you did see her? Suki, I mean. I thought you told the police you hadn't." "You saw Frank take her to her room?" I stared up at the pout of the woman's lips, hoping for even the meagrest description of Suki. The idea of her living, still in our town, our world, dressed in her own clothes,